Good morning. My name is Vincent Watkins. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Return to Flight Task Group. Welcome to our June 8th Webster Civic Center public meeting. First, let me mention that charts are available in the room and also available at our returntoflight.org website. Meeting audio is being distributed via the Internet, and it's being recorded and will be available on our website at the end of this meeting. Task group members were reminded to please use the microphone when speaking. Press once to turn the mic on, once to turn the mic off. For those members who are presenting, please refer to page numbers as you brief. Visitors are reminded to set their cell phones and pagers to the vibrate mode, and we request no flash photography. We also have Bill Anders or Bill Wagner on the line. Bill, can you hear me loud and clear?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I'm going to conduct a roll call and start out first with our co-chair, Lieutenant General Tom Stafford, Mr. Richard Covey, representing the management panel, Dr. Dan Crippen, Dr. Walter Brognax, Mr. Gary Geyer, Mrs. Susan Livingston, Mr. Tom Tate. As I said, Mr. Wagner is on the phone. He's one of the management panel representatives as well. Technical panel lead is Mr. Joe Cozzopoli, Mr. Ben Cosgrove, Dr. Chuck Daniel, Mr. Richard Coors, Dr. Decatur Rogers, and Mr. Cy Rubenstein. And also representing the operations panel lead is Colonel Jim Adamson.
Here.
Dr. Kathy Clark, Colonel Susan Hams, Dr. Kathy Thornton, and Mr. Bob Seek is with us as well. He'll be joining us shortly. That's it for administrative remarks. I'll turn it over to Mr. Covey and General Stafford for opening remarks.
Good morning, and this probably one of the last public meetings we have, unless there's a few items to wrap up in probably a teleconference. And this process started back in August of 2003 with the charter established by the administrator. And I want to thank all the members of this panel who have spent so much time in their efforts visiting the NASA centers, obtaining data, going to contractors, tremendous conference calls, and also the staff members. From the staff that works for Vince Watkins and the cooperation that we've received from all efforts where we've visited both the contractors and NASA. So it's been a long effort. Also want to say thanks so much to the co-chairman, Dick Covey, who has spent more time by far than I have on this total effort and the leadership given to pull everything together. And we are near the end of meeting the intent and carrying out the requirements of the charter. So keep the remarks very brief. I'll turn it over to Dick.
Thank you, Tom. I'd like to welcome our public guests, both here in person and those that might be observing through NASA TV or on the web. As General Stafford says, we have been at this for a while, much longer than most of us had planned. We continue to be able to participate in the activities of the agency, understand what they're doing relative to our charter, which I will remind everybody that the specific limits of our charter were to provide an independent assessment to the NASA administrator in an advisory role, which we are required to be under FACA, but advice to the administrator on assessments that we completed to determine whether the actions taken by the agency had met the intent of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board's return to flight recommendations. Columbia Accident Investigation Board had 29 recommendations. 15 of those were designated as return to flight. Those were the focus and the purpose of our activity was to look at the actions taken and to determine, in our opinion, whether the intent had been met or not. We had expanded our activity to include another raising the bar action from the Space Shuttle program. As referred to Space Shuttle program action 3 or SSP-3, which had to do with safe haven and a rescue of a crew, basically the ability to provide contingency support for the shuttle crew on the space station because of the connection that we believe that had in the overall integrated risk assessment and framework that the agency was using for return to flight. We believe that we should also assess the agency's actions relative to the determination and implementation of a safe haven capability. As of today, we have concluded much of our fact-finding relative to almost all of the recommendations that 15 return flight recommendations in SSP-3. There are some that still remains, and because of that, we will be unable to completely disposition our assessments of all of the recommendations today. However, the substantial progress made by the agency, both in completing certain actions that help meet the intent of the recommendations, but also providing us with the documentation that we required of those actions, have allowed us to reach a point today where we will be able to enter into deliberations and complete assessments on a large number of the remaining open assessments. So from that standpoint, I believe this is a significant milestone that we're reaching that point. We also will discuss those three recommendations that we have not completed our assessments on. We'll identify some of the milestones that we believe have to be achieved before we can be in a position ready to bring closure to those assessments and a determination of whether the intent of the K recommendations were met or not. We should be, in a position to close a significant portion of our work today, yet there still will be some unresolved work that we will carry forward. It's the intent that this will probably be, unless there's some unforeseen circumstances, that this would be the last time that we would meet in a face-to-face manner in a public meeting. Any subsequent public meetings would be based on a virtual or telephonic arrangement in order to disposition and to give us the flexibility that we need, given the time frame that we're in before the flight readiness review, to be able to disposition any remaining open assessments. Okay, I'll let one more administrative item, and then we'll turn the floor over to Dan Crippen and the management panel.
Let me also ask, are there any other task board members that are on the telephone besides yourself, Bill? Okay, Bill, let me ask that whenever you're not talking, to mute your mic. You can use *6 or use the mute button, and whenever you wish to speak, just unmute your mic. Do you copy, Bill?
Unmute.
And also, I failed to introduce our ex officio member, Mr. Jim Loa. He's here from NASA headquarters as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We hope to conclude today, and we'll recommend to the task group a conclusion of the recommendation, CABE recommendations under our purview. I want to also mention that over the last 2 days, we've had the pleasure of the company of Bill Anders and Ron Fogelman, who were not able to join us today. In fact, I'll be speaking not in a voice, but in the person of Bill Anders. I do want to take this opportunity to thank all of the management panel members who have put in literally hundreds of hours. Most of us recall the conversation we received in being asked to serve on this panel. And it went something like this: would you be willing to serve? And after the end of that conversation, most of us asked, well, how long do you anticipate this will be? And the answer was, we're going to launch next March. Obviously, we didn't know which march, or we may not have agreed, but we are now closing in, I think, on the literal return to flight and the end of our considerations, and I want to say that it's been a great pleasure to serve with the folks on my panel. As I've told many of them, one of the good things that comes for me, that comes of these activities, despite the time consumed, is that you get to meet people you would not otherwise ever have encountered, and some very good people at that. So for that, I'm grateful. We will begin with 621, Scheduling and Resources. This has been kind of a quiet recommendation from the sense of press or other inquiries, in large measure because we have concluded, as has been obvious to others, that for the return to flight efforts at least, budgetary resources have not been a constraint, and I will speak further to that in a moment. The recommendation, which you can see on the screen, says what probably is obvious to most people, that we should maintain a flight schedule consistent with resources. To do otherwise causes obvious problems. The instant case that the CABE was concerned with was trying to make a firm date for finishing construction of the space station and maintaining a flight schedule from that in their view, was probably a little ambitious and led to problems, not only the Columbia accident, but other intrinsic problems in trying to maintain that schedule. Bill Anders thinks that we ought to consider this and convinced us we ought to consider this as really two recommendations. And the next, I guess we didn't split it up here, but the point is that there is the first line of the recommendation, adopt and maintain a shuttle flight schedule consistent with available resources, is an obvious thing that one should do, and it is kind of a strategic statement. And that the second part of the recommendation is, although scheduled deadlines are an important management tool, those deadlines must be regularly evaluated to ensure that additional risk incurred to meet the schedule is recognized, understood, and acceptable. And it's this risk assessment is a piece of this recommendation, one that's important to keep in mind as part of the scheduling process. It is an area that we think NASA has made some pretty good progress on, the ability to understand and recognize risk. Next slide, you will see our interpretation. As I mentioned, we thought from the CABE documents and from their statements that their concern was focused on the completion of the space station as a function, forcing function here. NASA has done a great many things to implement this recommendation in addition to making sure there are sufficient resources. They've developed new tools and process in cooperation with their contractors to monitor schedule and implications of it. They have moved the scheduling functions to the Deputy Associate Administrator. Their quarterly program management reviews established to assess the program. So there have been a lot of tools created and processes created as well to better monitor the schedule. As I said, our assessment is that there are resource constraints, certainly budgetary resource constraints, has not been an apparent factor in the return to flight process. We do note, however, and think it's important to keep in mind for the public and NASA, that return to flight efforts will put pressure on future programs and vice versa, that the budget constraints will be biting in the future, as we all know about deficits and other things. But equally importantly, even inside a NASA top line, the future space program initiatives will compete inherently with the shuttle. And many of the things that have been done to improve the shuttle and to improve the wariness about its operation will be continuing costs. So we have to be ever vigilant about how we spend that money and recognize the pressures that will be inherent in the future. We believe that looking at how the schedule has evolved for return to flight, that the obvious is again apparent, and that is if one has a series of schedule changes and relatively ambitious, aggressive, optimistic, again in retrospect, hindsight, that by a shortened schedule precludes longer term, more ambitious, or maybe more applicable changes. We've heard a number of times folks say that if we'd known it would take 2 years to return to flight, we would have done X. And no one thinks that it was possible to know that it would take 2 years, but it is interesting, as others have noted on our panel, that for these major accidents, it has taken well over a year in all cases, and some said the average is 2 years. So it's pretty clear that these large efforts can't be accomplished in short time frames, even though we would like them to be. And by setting an ambitious or optimistic schedule, you preclude some of the options you might have otherwise had. So I think it's important that at the beginning of these kinds of large efforts, a well-thought-out set of objectives and plans, to the extent that we can do them, must be in place so that we have a realistic assessment of how long it's going to take. We all thought, as I said in my opening remarks, we agreed that our process, at least, if not NASA's, was only going to be for a few months. Obviously, we were wrong, too. So it's not that there's great knowledge here about how to schedule, but rather just the observation that overly aggressive schedules can limit your options. We continue to be concerned about workforce in the future. One of our early observations, as you may recall, was that given the number of new organizations within NASA, such as the NESC, that there would be a problem or potential problem in filling all of the skill requirements. The Systems Engineering and Integration Office is another example of a new organization that was going to take highly talented people potentially away from the existing shuttle program. And then with the advent of the President's Space Vision, the resources being drawn into that as well, coupled with the inevitable demographic and aging of the whole federal workforce, and the lack of or dearth of engineers being trained, we are concerned that the right skill mix of future in the future may not be readily available. And we urge NASA and others to keep a vigilant eye on that and do what they can to help train and supplement their existing workforce. Finally, another statement of the obvious, and that is that there will always be pressure on the schedule. We recognize, even those of us who aren't familiar with the space program, that schedules are an important part of management and program management. So it's not that there should not be a schedule, but rather that one just needs to be careful in establishing it, that it's not overly aggressive or that you don't increase schedule pressure too much. We've heard over and over again that schedule pressure is a good thing until it's a bad thing. And so it takes a lot of talent and thought to understand when you cross the line from good schedule pressure to bad. So we would, the management panel, Mr. Chairman, would recommend that the task group accept NASA's implementation package and actions to fulfill the recommendation of CABE 621.
Let's see. Any questions of Dan and the management panel relative to this recommendation? I would ask for a point of clarification, Dan, if we could go back to the previous slide. On the way that I understand that the determination that resource constraints were not an apparent factor in return to flight response would be that options were not ruled out because of resource limitations as being a criteria for how they would respond to the Accident Investigation Board's recommendations. Time might have been, but the cost or resources required to do something were not.
There may be, probably are, a time or two that we stumbled across where cost considerations may have precluded, but it was the larger questions of do we completely redesign something, and cost is a factor of that, but it's also time. So as a single unique factor, I don't know of any instance where simply cost was an inhibition. But certainly, while we have considered this, and the program has considered this to not be a constraint, it always is. I mean, there are obviously limits. So I can't tell you that in every case that every option was considered and never precluded because of cost. But much more common, as you suggested and as I've said, options were not considered or were considered and rejected because of time constraints much more often than anything else. So I don't know of no case, is a better way perhaps to answer your question, in which cost was the reason for not pursuing an option. Does that help?
Mr. Chairman, also if I could add to that, there was early guidance put out by the Space Shuttle Program. It was August 28, 2003, actually, which basically said that he did not want to have anyone preclude any technical solution coming forward because of some notional thought about schedule or cost impacts, that those were other issues and factors that would be brought into the mix later on as other things were weighed off, but that it was important that all the solutions be brought forward. So that guidance was put out in writing throughout the program.
It may be worth adding one note that we've had in previous reports and didn't include for today, but a number of the members, including Bill Wagner, who's on the phone, have spent time at the NASA centers talking to workforce and others and asked questions about schedule and pressure and resources. And I think it's fair to say, and Bill, correct me here if I'm wrong, but I think to a person in these offhand interviews, no one suggested that there was a resource constraint. I mean, that no one was told, no, we can't do that because it's too expensive when it came to considering options for return to flight.
We continue to be able to participate in the activities of the agency, understand what they're doing relative to our charter, which I will remind everybody that the specific limits of our charter were to provide an independent assessment to the NASA administrator in an advisory role, which we are required to be under FACA, but advice to the administrator on assessments that we completed to determine whether the actions taken by the agency had met the intent of the Columbia Accident Investigation Board's return-to-flight recommendations. Columbia Accident Investigation Board had 29 recommendations. 15 of those were designated as return to flight. Those were the focus and the purpose of our activity was to look at the actions taken and to determine, in our opinion, whether the intent had been met or not. We had expanded our activity to include another raising the bar action from the Space Shuttle Program, as referred to Space Shuttle Program Action 3 or SSP-3, which had to do with safe haven and a rescue of a crew, basically the ability to provide contingency support for the shuttle crew on the space station because of the connection that we believe that had in the overall integrated risk assessment and framework that the agency was using for return to flight. We believe that we should also assess the agency's actions relative to the determination and implementation of a safe haven capability. As of today, we have concluded much of our fact-finding relative to almost all of the recommendations that 15 return to flight recommendations in SSP-3. There are some that still remains. And because of that, we will be unable to completely disposition our assessments of all of the recommendations today. However, the substantial progress made by the agency, both in completing certain actions that help meet the intent of the recommendations, but also providing us with the documentation that we required of those actions, have allowed us to reach a point today where we will be able to enter into deliberations and complete assessments on a large number of the remaining open assessments. So from that standpoint, I believe this is a significant milestone that we're reaching that point. We also will discuss those three recommendations that we have not completed our assessments on. We'll identify some of the milestones that we believe have to be achieved before we can be in a position ready to bring closure to those assessments and a determination of whether the intended K recommendations were met or not. So we should be, in a position to close a significant portion of our work today, yet there still will be some unresolved work that we will carry forward. It's the intent that this will probably be, unless there's some unforeseen circumstances, that this would be the last time that we would meet in a face-to-face manner in a public meeting. Any subsequent public meetings would be based on a virtual or telephonic arrangement in order to disposition and to give us the flexibility that we need, given the time frame that we're in before the flight readiness review, to be able to disposition any remaining open assessments. Okay, I'll let one more administrative item, and then we'll turn the floor over to Dan Crippen and the management panel.
Let me also ask, are there any other task group members that are on the telephone besides yourself, Bill? Okay, Bill, let me ask that whenever you're not talking, to mute your mic. You can use *6 or use the mute button, and whenever you wish to speak, just unmute your mic. Do you copy, Bill?
He's on mute.
And also, I failed to introduce our ex officio member, Mr. Jim Loy. He's here from NASA headquarters as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We hope to conclude today, and we'll recommend to the task group a conclusion of the recommendation, K recommendations under our purview. I want to also mention that over the last 2 days, we've had the pleasure of the company of Bill Anders and Ron Fogelman, who were not able to join us today. In fact, I'll be speaking not in a voice, but in the person of Bill Anders. I do want to take this opportunity to thank all of the management panel members who have put in literally hundreds of hours. Most of us recall the conversation we received in being asked to serve on this panel, and it went something like this. Would you be willing to serve? And after the end of that conversation, most of us asked, well, how long do you anticipate this will be? And the answer was, we're going to launch next March. Obviously, we didn't know which March, or we may not have agreed, but we are now closing in, I think, on the literal return to flight and the end of our considerations, and I want to say that it's been a great pleasure to serve with the folks on my panel. As I've told many of them, one of the good things that comes for me, that comes of these activities, despite the time consumed, is that you get to meet people you would not otherwise ever have encountered, and some very good people at that. So for that, I'm grateful. We will begin with 621, Scheduling and Resources. This has been kind of a quiet recommendation from the sense of press or other inquiries, in large measure because we have concluded, as has been obvious to others, that for the return to flight efforts at least, budgetary resources have not been a constraint, and I will speak further to that in a moment. The recommendation, which you can see on the screen, says what probably is obvious to most people, that we should maintain a flight schedule consistent with resources. To do otherwise causes obvious problems. The instant case that the CABE was concerned with was trying to make a firm date for finishing construction of the space station and maintaining a flight schedule from that in their view, was probably a little ambitious and led to problems, not only the Columbia accident, but other intrinsic problems in trying to maintain that schedule. Bill Anders thinks that we ought to consider this and convinced us we ought to consider this as really two recommendations. And the next, I guess we didn't split it up here, but the point is that there is the first line of the recommendation, adopt and maintain a shuttle flight schedule consistent with available resources. is an obvious thing that one should do, and it is kind of a strategic statement, and that the second part of the recommendation is although scheduled deadlines are important management tool, those deadlines must be regularly evaluated to ensure that additional risk incurred to meet the schedule is recognized, understood, and acceptable. And it's this risk assessment is a piece of this recommendation, one that's important to keep in mind as part of the scheduling process. It is an area that we think NASA has made some pretty good progress on, the ability to understand and recognize risk. Next slide, you will see our interpretation. As I mentioned, we thought from the CABE documents and from their statements that their concern was focused on the completion of the space station as a function, forcing function here. NASA has done a great many things to implement this recommendation in addition to making sure there are sufficient resources. They've developed new tools and process in cooperation with their contractors to monitor schedule and implications of it. They have moved the scheduling functions to the Deputy Associate Administrator. Their quarterly program management reviews established to assess the program. So there have been a lot of tools created and processes created as well to better monitor the schedule. As I said, our assessment is that there are resource constraints, certainly budgetary resource constraints, has not been an apparent factor in the return to flight process. We do note, however, and think it's important to keep in mind for the public and NASA, that return to flight efforts will put pressure on future programs and vice versa, that the budget constraints will be biting in the future, as we all know about deficits and other things. But equally importantly, even inside a NASA top line, the future space program initiatives will compete inherently with the shuttle. And many of the things that have been done to improve the shuttle and to improve the wariness about its operation will be continuing costs. So we have to be ever vigilant about how we spend that money and recognize the pressures that will be inherent in the future. We believe that looking at, in retrospect, looking at how the schedule has evolved for return to flight, that the obvious is again apparent, and that is if one has a series of schedule changes and relatively ambitious, aggressive, optimistic, again in retrospect, hindsight, that by a shortened schedule precludes longer-term, more ambitious, or maybe more applicable changes. We've heard a number of times folks say that if we'd known it would take 2 years to return to flight, we would have done X. And no one thinks that it was possible to know that it would take 2 years, but it is interesting, as others have noted on our panel, that for these major accidents, it has taken well over a year in all cases, and some said the average is 2 years. So it's pretty clear that these large efforts can't be accomplished in short time frames, even though we would like them to be. And by setting an ambitious or optimistic schedule, you preclude some of the options you might have otherwise had. So I think it's important that at the beginning of these kinds of large efforts, a well-thought-out set of objectives and plans, to the extent that we can do them, must be in place so that we have a realistic assessment of how long it's going to take. We all thought, as I said in my opening remarks, we agreed that our process, at least, if not NASA's, was only going to be for a few months. Obviously, we were wrong, too. So it's not that there's great knowledge here about how to schedule, but rather just the observation that overly aggressive schedules can limit your options. We continue to be concerned about workforce in the future. One of our early observations, as you may recall, was that given the number of new organizations within NASA, such as the NASC, that there would be a problem or potential problem in filling all of the skill requirements. The Systems Engineering and Integration Office is another example of a new organization that was going to take highly talented people potentially away from the existing shuttle program. And then with the advent of the President's Space Vision, the resources being drawn into that as well. coupled with the inevitable demographic and aging of the whole federal workforce and the lack of or dearth of engineers being trained, we are concerned that the right skill mix of future in the future may not be readily available, and we urge NASA and others to keep a vigilant eye on that and do what they can to help train and supplement their existing workforce. Finally, another statement of the obvious, and that is that there will always be pressure on the schedule. We recognize, even those of us who aren't familiar with the space program, that schedules are an important part of management and program management. So it's not that there should not be a schedule, but rather that one just needs to be careful in establishing it, that it's not overly aggressive or that you don't increase schedule pressure too much. We've heard over and over again that schedule pressure is a good thing until it's a bad thing. And so it takes a lot of talent and thought to understand when you cross the line from good schedule pressure to bad. So we would, the management panel, Mr. Chairman, would recommend that the task group accept NASA's implementation package and actions to fulfill the recommendation of CABE 621.
Let's see. Any questions of Dan and the management panel relative to this recommendation? I would ask for a point of clarification, Dan. If we could go back to the previous slide. On the way that I understand that the determination that resource constraints were not an apparent factor in the return to flight response would be that options were not ruled out because of resource limitations as being a criteria for how they would respond to the Accident Investigation Board's recommendations. Time might have been, but the cost or resources required to do something were not.
There may be, probably are, a time or two that we stumbled across where cost considerations may have precluded, but it was the larger questions of do we completely redesign something, and cost is a factor of that, but it's also time. So as a single unique factor, I don't know of any instance where simply cost was an inhibition. But certainly, while we have considered this, and the program has considered this to not be a constraint, it always is. I mean, there are obviously limits. So I can't tell you that in every case that every option was considered and never precluded because of cost. But much more common, as you suggested and as I've said, options were not considered or were considered and rejected because of time constraints much more often than anything else. So I don't know of no case, as a better way perhaps to answer your question, in which cost was the reason for not pursuing an option. Does that help?
Mr. Chairman, also if I could add to that, there was early guidance put out by the Space Shuttle Program. It was August 28, 2003, actually, which basically said that he did not want to have anyone preclude any technical solution coming forward because of some notional thought about schedule or cost impacts. That those were other issues and factors that would be brought into the mix later on as other things were weighed off, but that it was important that all the solutions be brought forward. So that guidance was put out in writing throughout the program.
It may be worth adding one note that we've had in previous reports and didn't include for today, but a number of the members, including Bill Wagner, who's on the phone, have spent time at the NASA centers talking to workforce and others and asked questions about schedule and pressure and resources. And I think it's fair to say, and Bill, correct me here if I'm wrong, but I think to a person in these offhand interviews, no one suggested that there was a resource constraint. I mean, no one was told, no, we can't do that because it's too expensive when it came to considering options for return to flight.
Thank you. Are there any other questions on this issue? If not, unless there's an objection, I recommend that based on the closure package submitted by NASA and the management panel's presentation, our discussion here today, that the record will reflect that the task group believes that NASA has met the intent of the CABE recommendation and that we accept the NASA's request for closure of our assessment of CABE recommendation 6-2-1.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We will move to CABE recommendation 6-3-1, mission management team improvements. Susan Livingston will lead our discussion on that. Before she begins, however, I want to recognize Susan in particular for all of the literally hundreds of hours she's put in on this effort. And frankly, I think the outcome would not have been nearly as robust if she had not been constantly involved in asking questions about how things are going to work. So this has been an outstanding effort. I think the result is better than we had actually anticipated some months ago, and largely due to Susan's efforts in cooperation.
Thank you, Dan, for those kind remarks. We're on page 12 of the slides, in case everyone's gotten lost during the process thus far. But this was a very collaborative effort, not only among task force members, although the management panel was assigned the lead on this particular recommendation, there was very, very active involvement from all other return-to-flight panel members from both the operations panel and the technical panel. So this was a very collaborative effort. And the reason for that collaboration in particular was because early on the return-to-flight task group recognized that this particular recommendation that the CABE had made in the report was the primary mechanism where a lot of other CABE recommendations and issues could come together in an integrated fashion for observation and for the task group to take a look at. So all of us had a very keen interest in what the mission management team was doing. I would also, before we leave page 12, I really give NASA some kudos here, too. Dan had some very kind remarks to say about our task group involvement and on this particular area, but this has been a recommendation in which NASA has responded very fully and very proactively to a lot of recommendations or suggestions that we may have made on this particular area, and probably thought at times that we'd probably never go away in terms of coming up with new ideas. But I want to recognize their efforts on this too. If we could go to page 13. This particular recommendation, and you can read it for yourself, was relatively straightforward. Just in terms of the wording of it, implementing an expanded training program, and they did require that training program cover contingencies in which there would be the potential loss of the shuttle or crew, and of course contain a number of uncertainties and unknowns. But in addition to that, the Columbia Accident Investigation Board very much wanted to see this type of training involve the full panoply of feed groups and support groups and teams that go into the decision-making documents and materials and analyses that go into the MMT. If we go on to page 14, while the wording itself was very straightforward in the Columbia Accident Investigation Board report, the intent, when you read that report, it becomes very clear it was far more complex. They came across with very significant criticisms of the mission management team in terms of their organizational behaviors and the decision-making during STS-107. And indeed, there were about 29 findings, I believe, that they made on various failures they saw in decision-making or processes or feeder groups or procedures coming into the this critical decision-making body. Some of the criticisms that they noted, and I'm sure Everyone here probably has taken a very good and strong look at that report already, but it was the inexperience and interpretation of data that was coming into the mission management team was one of their areas of concern. They mentioned and criticized the MMT for relying more on sort of the trusted agent or experience rather than a rigorous analytical basis for some of their decision-making. They found that there were lapses in terms of MMT procedures, lapses in terms of MMT leadership, lapses in terms of effective communication within the mission management team. They also were critical of the fact that in those discussions that did occur within the mission management team, that there was not what they would have expected to be the disciplined, rigorous assessment of not just the analyses presented to them, but the knowns and unknowns in those analyses, the assumptions, the ramifications, the limitations of the information that was coming in for decision making. And finally, just two other points of criticism that they did make were the passivity of the safety representatives within the MMT, which led, of course, later on to a recommendation that Dr. Crippen will address, which was to ensure enhanced and greater independence of that safety role within the space shuttle program inputs. And finally, they found that there were no avenues for dissent or expression of concern, that these were sort of not welcomed, and they were concerned about that, that people were, did not feel free to be able or have avenues to speak up and issue some of the concerns or get forward some of the issues that they had to the mission management team in a very timely way. In addition to those, the specific CABE findings, the Return to Flight Task Group, as I mentioned earlier, also recognized that, there were many new capabilities embedded in the other CABE Return to Flight, particularly in the areas of inspection and imagery. In addition, although it was a raise-the-bar action, the whole concept of the contingency shuttle crew support and launch on need were going to have major ramifications and complexities in terms of risk versus risk trades coming into the mission management team. And so the Return to Flight Task Group made some recommendations for additional actions that the MMT really needed to do to be able to address some of these other return to flight recommendations and to exercise them within their decision-making arena. And those specifically focused, we gave them actual closure criteria that reference some of these, but again, they focus predominantly on the integrated imagery capabilities and the CSCS launch on need. Another area the Return to Flight Task Group placed great emphasis on was that there be very strong evaluative mechanisms, corrective mechanisms, closed lesson learned loops, formal training objectives for this expanded training program, and metrics by which the MMT could evaluate themselves, learn from their training efforts, and affect a very continuous improvement process throughout the life of the shuttle. This was something where human dynamics being what they are, sometimes there's a tendency to revert back to organizational behaviors that may be more embedded in the organization or more in the comfort zone of the members. And so there was a very strong emphasis placed on the fact that, you know, you've got a great progress here, great baseline here, but this needs to grow, it needs to mature, it needs to constantly improve. The Return to Flight Group also made two of the closures of CABE recommendations subject to actual simulation in the mission management team. Those included the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, MOU, used to be known as NEMA, MOU, and also the closeout photo recommendation that the Columbia Accident Investigation Board made. If we could go on to 15. NASA implementation, as I indicated earlier, NASA very quickly stepped out to address this particular Columbia Accident Investigation Board report recommendation. Their actions were serious, they were substantive, and they were very, very extensive. A few examples of areas here. There's literally and virtually every aspect of the mission management team before Columbia and as it is today has been changed. Membership has been expanded. Membership roles and clarity of those roles have been defined and have been documented. Responsibilities have been defined and documented. We have the chairmanship has been standardized. The organizational approaches that the MMT must make during their decision making have been standardized. The corrective actions have focused not just on the team itself and how they relate dynamically with each other, but also on individual member effectiveness as well. The procedures themselves have been exercised now, the revised procedures in 13 mission management team simulations. These simulations are a major investment in time and resource and training for the mission management team. Some of them have involved up to, I think, well over 1,000 people throughout the system in terms of simulating real-time mission management decision-making challenge or as if it were operational. The most recent member that's been added to the mission management team also is the shuttle system technical warrant holder. And again, Dr. Crippen will be addressing that particular CABE recommendation later, but the so-called ITA or technical warrant holder is now a voting member of the mission management team. Formal advisory members also exist. They have added the NESC, the Engineering Safety Center that NASA had established post-Columbia. And in addition to those, formal advisory members are the Safety Mission Assurance Offices from Kennedy and Marshall and Johnson Space Centers. Before Columbia, the predominant training of the MMT consisted of, I think, about one simulation every 18 months. Currently, this has been expanded exponentially. There is formal classroom training. There is self-instructional requirements. There are two simulations that will be required to be held each year. And there's an initial certification process that ensures that people have gone through required training before they can serve on the MMT. And then there's an annual sustainment requirement that gets updated annually for sustainment of their membership on the MMT. The mission management team folks have now established training objectives. They have formal metrics for evaluation and of their processes. They have a closed lesson learned loop, which provides captures not only lessons learned that they have themselves observed during some of their training activities, but also those of their external independent outside evaluators, including those from the Office of the Inspector General that have attended some of these training sessions or all of these training sessions. These evaluative mechanisms we heartily encouraged. We are very welcome them and are glad to see them. They do need to mature and gain sophistication because these are critical in any training endeavor in terms of ensuring progress and improvement over time. The mission management team also has opened up a number of channels for communication of dissent and concern. These can be done on the record. These can be done anonymously. There's suggestion boxes. There's web access. There's whatever. And each one of those gets documented and needs to be responded to. So they have opened up those avenues very, very broadly. In addition to just the mission management team members, the support and feeder groups have revised their procedures, improved their procedures as well to support the MMT, including contractual folks. There has been a mission evaluation room console handbook that's been developed. In terms of taking the integrated inspection and imagery capabilities of the shuttle, there has been an operation integration plan and a mission evaluation room annex developed for that plan to help guide and direct decision-making on the inspection capabilities that are going to be aboard STS-114. Further, the shuttle and the shuttle mission management team and the International Space Station mission management team have co-trained, cross-trained. They sit in on each other's meetings now. They're working and improving and standardizing communications and approaches to things, integrated anomaly lists, integrated risk assessment lists now include not just shuttle issues, but also those that are aboard the space station, recognizing the symbiotic relationship between the two, particularly with the potential of CSCS or a launch on need at one point. I'd like to give hearty kudos to Christine Fox on leading the Integrated Vehicle Assessment Subpanel and the folks at NASA that worked on this Operation Integration Plan for a TPS assessment. It's a very excellent document. It's a great forward step in terms of integration and integrating decision-making, and I'd just like to take a moment to give them kudos for the work that's been done there. At our next plenary, there will be a report out on this integrated imagery effort. Support and the MER logistics support have been vitally improved and vastly improved. They have web-based connectivity. There is now video teleconferencing. Remote sites are I think, feel far more engaged now through the video conferencing than was heretofore available to them. If we go on to slide 16, please. In terms of our fact-finding and assessment, the return-to-flight task group, all panel members or a number of panel members from all three panels have attended different types of training. They have spoken to different support groups, ranging from the mission evaluation room to the TPS assessment imagery teams to sitting in on the simulations to attending classroom training to talking to a huge number of people in the various organizations and membership groups that are there. And we wrote up observation reports from those trips that we made in terms of the specific ones on simulation. And given all this, our overall assessment, and Mr. Co-Chairman, is that the mission management team has made notable progress and great maturity in making the improvements that the CABE found. These are to be heartily praised in terms of their work through the 13 simulations and the improvements that have been made. Also, as the shuttle launch was delayed, one of the things that's always helpful to observe is a commitment by any organization, in this case NASA, of course, to continual improvement, and they use that time to continue to improve documents, to hold additional simulations, to improve their evaluative mechanisms. So this has not been, this was not something that was just done up front and then just sort of tested through. It's been iteration after iteration of improvement. So the bottom line here is there's great progress thus far in making the mission management team an incredibly effective organization. As one individual, not on the task group, said, this would have not recognized the MMT as it is today given the past practices. But all that said, this is a journey, not an end. There is never such thing as training being over or processes that can stagnate or not change over time. So with all the things that NASA has done thus far, it's very, very important that they continue to develop and improve. And a couple of instances of this sort of come to mind. The most immediate one in my mind is the mission management team is a very time-critical decision-making body that is going to deal with incredible complex knowns, unknowns, uncertainties, et cetera. And many of the analytical bases are not going to be black and white. There will be some limitations to them. There will be some grays, et cetera. So between now and shuttle launch, there are still going to be decisions that are going to be affecting the knowledge and analytical bases coming into the MMT. These will come out of such things as the Delta debris verification review and even perhaps a flight readiness review and out of the safety and mission assurance readiness review. And so it's important, and I'm not concerned about this because most of the MMT members sit on a lot of these boards and they're there and they will have this message. But it's important that the MMT have the understanding and have the confidence in the analytical bases that are coming into them. So as those change or may or become different over time or even between now and launch, they need to ensure that those particular mechanisms and changes are well known within the mission management team. In addition, as I indicated, this is a journey, not an end. They have got to continue and have ongoing improvement of their training evaluation system, of their performance, and of the many support documents that come into the mission management team. These support documents are all living documents. They are never probably going to be finished. They're going to be iteration after iteration of change as things change. The most important one here is a living document is the Operation Integration Plan for TPS assessment. So those living documents need to be maintained. Don't want to sound bureaucratic here, but documentation is critical in this particular area because mission management team members change over time, and when they're referencing to processes and procedures, they need to know the latest and the greatest and how it works. So again, NASA's done a very fine job thus far in documenting the changes and the processes they've made to date that needs to be maintained over time. Another area of focus that I would hope to see for the mission management team is for them to have and grow, well, they have, but to mature their capability for an integrated risk versus risk identification and assessment process. Those of you who may have not sat through a mission management team meeting before, this is a group that has very critical, very time-sensitive decisions that may need to be made. And as a result of that, it would help them to have a more mature framework, or maturing, I shouldn't say more mature, but a maturing framework as things change to help them deal with all these unknowns, limitations, and assumptions, analytical bases for things, the models coming in, and perhaps building or leveraging off what is known, but then giving them a framework by which to keep all these multiple variables before them in a cognizant way so people do not lose sight of where they are in this incredibly complex confluence of decision information that's going to be coming into them. Another area that I had mentioned earlier was that in the simulations themselves, some of these so-called full-up simulations involved massive, massive numbers of contractor personnel and NASA personnel. They take hundreds, I don't know, thousands of hours in planning and preparation. And within those simulation environments, and given the number of people and the feeder groups involved, there is probably a tremendous potential there that could be even more effectively utilized to test out and validate other things beyond just training the MMT. Certain anomalies that are selected, whatever, coming in could give a very good test environment to see how this exercises in a operational environment during the MMT simulations. And so it's one of those issues that, you know, when you have a training requirement that has a involvement of a huge amount of time and resources, I guess my comment here is basically to kind of see it in the broader context of potential and get the biggest bang for your buck, because there's a lot of areas that can be or great other opportunities for testing other areas than just beyond complying with the MMT training area. Two other little points I want to mention here. In the post-Columbia mission management team, the role of headquarters senior leadership has changed. And it's changed in a couple of areas and probably other areas as well. But given the Columbia Accident Investigation Board's report on safety and mission assurance and the independence there, the SMA folks have suspension authority. They literally can stop an action from moving forward. The independent technical authority could also, who has sole waiver authority, could have an issue that could come up that would preclude or say I cannot support that waiver. I'm talking now during an operational point within the mission management team. the invocation of the CSCS or launch and launch on need is not a mission management team decision. This is going to go way up, but they do have to make a recommendation. And so as the MMT continues their training scenarios, I see an opportunity periodically that senior leadership probably should engage and be part of those trainings, not that they don't know how to make decisions or how to play in that process, but it's important that the MMT itself know what kind of information those individuals are going to need when they have to bump a decision up to Washington, D.C., perhaps, for a very quick turnaround, a very quick resolution. And finally, I think it's important that there be an annual independent evaluation of the MMT. Now, mission management team itself has independent evaluators that sit in on their simulations. They provide evaluation comments. They're working with them on their training plan, classroom, and self-instructional materials. But I'm talking here about taking a critical look at this, the progress and the continued improvements of the mission management team on an annual basis. And no particular recommendation who or how that should be done, but I think it's important to maintain that assessment, because this group is very, very important to the shuttle program. Now, I say this in the context of not trying to pick out the MMT as you know, this is the only thing you really need to take a look at. But the mission management team is a unique body in that so many things come to bear within that environment. And so it's a very good arena for senior leaders to be able to observe how the organizational dynamics are working within the shuttle program. And last page, please. That management team chairman, but also the co-chairman, our recommendation is to accept NASA's implementation of this. Give them kudos for some, a lot of hard work and great action, and tell them just to keep going for it. Thank you.
Okay. I would ask for questions of Susan or the management panel relative to this recommendation. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I have a question. Some of us were back in the old days, and the Mercury program, when this first started, used to call it Flight Control Operations. The father of that was Dr. Christopher Kraft, who did a lot of simulations, flight simulations, to get the flight people ready for putting the first man in space. And then follow on with Gene Kranz and his success on keeping Apollo 13 from being a disaster. I was wondering if anyone on the management group has talked to those two individuals, and have they witnessed some of this? Because that's where that experience really is.
Gene Kranz, I know specifically, has attended one of the simulations and provided comments to the mission management team folks and debriefed them on that assessment. Whether or not there had been discussions with others, I do not know. I do believe that there's opportunity for NASA to continue to improve their simulation and the characteristics of those simulations. They can do that, I think, internally by looking at a lot of the bright minds that are around here as well, but also there's obviously a lot of other governmental organizations that have very extensive simulation capabilities, and I think have probably had a lot of great lessons learned and probably could contribute to improvements as these simulations continue over time.
Yeah, other senior... Other questions? I have at least one. You know, 13 mission management team simulations. My experience is simulations are part of the overall training and preparation that's done for any type of team. We put a great deal of credence on them in this time period. because there haven't been ongoing operations. The concern I would have is has the activity that's taken place in getting the mission management team training improved to this point really sustainable in the form that has taken place over the last 2 years?
And I welcome comments from the rest of the task group members that have attended these simulations. There have been several simulations that were paper simulations, and in a paper simulation environment, you only do so much. But there's been a number of full-up simulations that I think that have very effectively exercised the entire organization in a lot of areas, not just feeding into the mission management team, but the feeder groups themselves or the analytical groups themselves that provide information to the mission management team for decision-making have backed their own simulations, component sims, as they call them, and held a number of simulation events leading into then participating in the larger simulated environment for the mission management team. So there's been, I think, the MMT simulation training has provided as sort of a ripple effect in terms of keeping other groups exercised in the type of work that they're going to need to do on launch of STS-114. But again, I'd ask those who have attended beyond myself to comment.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we saw that was very useful in the MMTs as they developed was that it necessitated having discussions that I don't think they would otherwise have had. And these are the discussions behind making some of these very difficult decisions. And so that was, I'm still not sure that we as a group are convinced that because they made a decision during MMT, they would make that same decision in a real life situation, because you can't really simulate that. But at least the discussions began to take place. And that was an incredibly important thing, because it really got everybody involved and they began to understand what information they needed to have in order to hold those discussions. So that was the part I was pleased about.
Okay, but again, as the ops tempo picks up, do you feel that they've looked at the future environment for maintaining the training as opposed to this interim environment where, you know, there was time to be able to do more before STS-114? As the ops tempo picks up, this mission management team will be up and running for all of the flights. Have they looked at what does it take from the standpoint of, you know, if we got ongoing operations, how do you sustain? And not all of those ongoing missions will exercise all of the capabilities of the mission management team. Or potential requirements for mission management, types of decisions they would have to make. Do you feel that they've really been able to establish in an ops tempo type of environment, 4 flights a year, 5 flights a year, whatever, what it would take to maintain? And it's not just simulations. I understand simulations are just one piece of it, because there's a lot of other preparation for participation in the MMT in an effective way that's involved in it. Is it something that they've addressed in a way that you believe is sustainable?
The short answer to that is yes. The one area there's the follow-on training for the MMT members once certified is most definitely sustainable. What is going to be a challenge to the mission management team is a new member that's coming in as they're hitting their operational tempo and demands to get through all of the classroom and self-instructional requirements that are required for certification, plus do the operational aspects that are going to be required, plus then attend at least one simulation event per year. That is doable. It's going to be a challenge. It'll require a significant investment of time on behalf of these new members should they come in. The members that are already been trained and certified, their actual sustainment is, I think, most doable within the context of an operational environment. What's interesting, as I the mission management team folks and the training folks have committed to keeping this training improved and constantly sort of refreshed. And I think as lessons are learned out of actual operational environments, that will roll in and probably make the actual training more pertinent and effective to them as well, to include perhaps some changes in training on analytical bases that may be changed or revised coming into the mission management team. So it's doable. I think for new members, it's going to be a challenge to get the certification training at the same time that they're doing operational.
And Dick and I would add that obviously as the flight rate increases, the MMT gets more real experience as opposed to simulated experience, if that's a good way to put it. And I think what's important is what Susan touched on, they need to have some process for self-assessment of the performance of the team. Not only, the members that have been there for some number of missions, but the new folks that are coming on board. They need a process that continually looks at things so that what happened at the Columbia time doesn't occur, the erosion of the discipline and that sort of thing. They need some way to stay on top of that with self-assessments or independent assessments or something like that.
And
in addition to
scheduled
periodic simulations, obviously.
And those are scheduled. And indeed, I mean, the initial training plan has been published and put out. There are going to be annual updates. And I think based on lessons learned of the effectiveness and how this training works in the operational environment, there may be further changes based on their own evaluation of the requirements and needs. This is not, fortunately, again, it's a living document. It's not something that's, been put out there and is going to be there, forever. It's going to be evaluated for effectiveness and will be revised as necessary.
Any additional questions for the management panel or Susan? I too, would like to, as Dan did, recognize the substantial effort that Susan and other members of the task group put into this particular recommendation. I think you raised the bar in your expectations of how the agency would respond to this. I think they did respond and are better for it. Certainly, their response to our expectations made our job easier in the end, as opposed to leaving questions in our mind as to the effectiveness and the completeness of their preparation for future mission management team activities. So thank you, Susan and others, for helping raise the bar. Unless there's an objection, I recommend that based on the closure package submitted by NASA and the management panel's presentation and deliberation here today, that the record reflect that the task group believes that NASA has met the intent of the CABE recommendation, and we accept NASA's request for closure of CABE recommendation 6.3-1.
Mr. Chairman, we'll turn to recommendation 911. That's sometimes hard to describe. Because of the way CABE organized it, I will probably start and finish with an attempt to explain. 911 is one of the 15 return to flight recommendations. However, embedded in it are several subpoints or other recommendations. But 911 itself, as you can see from the literal words, call for a detailed plan. And the detailed plan is to include the organizations and reorganization called for in 751, 52, and 53. So as we go through this, it will be potentially confusing. And I have written this, as you've seen in interim reports, in several different ways and not been able to clarify it necessarily very well. When we say that we are recommending that to the task group that NASA has indeed met the intent of CABE on 911, it is this recommendation we're referring to and not the subcomponents, as we will see. We will go through each of the 7.5 recommendations in order and speak to them as well so that you get a sense of where NASA is on both the planning and, in some cases, the implementation of these recommendations that are embedded in 911. But again, our recommendation will be to the task group that they accept that NASA has prepared a detailed plan for each of these three sections and met the intent of CABE without necessarily, as you will see, having to reach that conclusion on each of the individual 7-5 recommendations.
Dan, if I could interrupt just a second. We believe that CABE put this recommendation in and didn't put 751, 752, and 753 as return of flight recommendations because they didn't want to they did not know the amount of time it would take to make organizational changes to reflect 751, 2, and 3, but wanted to make sure that it wasn't pushed off and left to sometime in the future, therefore asked for a detailed plan on the implementation, which could take place subsequent to return to flight, if return to flight was possible in the first 6 months or a year or whatever. That's why we believe they did it this way. One is to keep the focus on the organizational changes that they believe were required and documented in their recommendations, yet not establish the requirement that the organizational changes be made before the first flight, only that a plan was there. In fact, because of the time between the report and actual return to flight and the completion of our deliberations, substantial progress has been made in implementation of those, and so that's the basis upon which some of you're talking about that we have been able to observe and look at actual implementation progress and can make some judgments on that.
Yeah, absolutely correct. Okay. I think CABE was also concerned that if they said all of these reorganizations needed to take place as opposed to the plan before return to flight, and return to flight were any time soon after the report, that you would throw NASA into an organizational tailspin right before you were asking them to do all these other things. So there was recognition that there's substantial change called for in these recommendations, and that change could not be accomplished overnight. Subsequent to, in fact, to put a little finer point on your observation, Mr. Chairman, subsequent to the CABE recommendations, the NASA administrator called for the implementation of 751 before return to flight for the space shuttle program or for the agency-wide, but to eventually apply it agency-wide, but to implement it for the space shuttle program before return to flight. So there was further recognition that there was important change here, that the time allowed was sufficient to implement it. On slide 3 of this deck, you'll see further CABE words about what the 751 piece of this was to include. And it was very specific. As you can see from the bullet points, these are from the CABE report and recommendation. Develop and maintain technical standards. Be the sole waiver granting authority. Conduct trend and risk analysis, and so on. And we have held NASA to these particular tasks being included in the ITA. There were early on a number of proposals of how the ITA would work that didn't include all of these tasks, and we were quite insistent that that's entirely up to NASA, but that if these tasks were not included, the CABE intent would not be met. Ultimately, as we'll see in the implementation, which is on page 5 here. No, let's implement it. Yes. That the ITA has been constructed, modeled in part after Navy programs, in which there is a single authority, namely the chief engineer, for establishing and maintaining technical standards. The chief engineer has chosen to delegate some of that authority to institutions called technical warrant holders. These are folks within NASA and who work for NASA as government employees who are recognized as the best technical experts in each of the given fields that they've chosen to note. The engineer, the chief engineer, then delegates to these technical warrant holders the authorities of the chief engineer as the ITA, so that a person who is the NASA expert on a particular issue is the technical warrant holder, establishes the requirements, the technical requirements for agency-wide use where that's applicable or for programs where they're program-specific, and that the warrant holder has the right to waive or enforce that requirement if the program deems it necessary to ask for relief. The process then, if the warrant holder and the program cannot agree, the process can go up the chain, of course, all the way to the administrator if necessary to make a decision on whether it's appropriate to waive certain technical authorities. As many of you know, the CABE was interested here in trying to separate from the program the responsibilities for managing schedule, cost, and technical excellence or competency. And while the program clearly will still be highly involved and mostly responsible for whatever technical accomplishments they have, the CABE was concerned that it was an inherent conflict of interest to have to manage budget and schedule at the same time being asked to waive certain technical requirements. And so they recommended that the organization, that NASA, remove that particular piece of authority from the program manager. As you can see from this organizational chart that NASA has created, the NASA chief engineer is the technical authority, has the ability through technical warrant holders to delegate that authority back down the chain. So in a simplistic way, what would happen is if the program wanted a waiver to the technical requirements, they must go to the warrant holder to get that waiver. The program no longer has the ability to unilaterally waive its technical requirements. One of the things that doesn't show on this org chart is another activity NASA undertook shortly after the CABE report, which was to create the NASA Engineering and Safety Center. NESC is an independent of the program center of almost 100 experts who are able to respond to inquiries from the chief engineer, from the head of safety and mission assurance, and from the programs and elements themselves for help on technical matters. They have been, NESC has been heavily involved in the return to flight efforts on both technical assessment of issues of gaskets, for example, grease, other things, but as well involved in helping to analyze the models that are being developed and used to assess risk and to help determine damage possibilities or return to flight. So the NESC is also on this chart, if you will, although not obvious, not literally true, reports to the chief engineer, but is responsive to the head of safety and mission assurance as well as programs and elements within NASA. On page 7 of this, of my deck, but page 24, these are the principles that the administrator first enunciated of the development of the ITA. And those principles have been followed and we think are wholly consistent with the intent of CABE. I won't go through them individually. You'll see on the next slide, NASA Engineering Safety Center I referred to and how it was set up. Next, you will see that our assessment is that the plan for and indeed the implementation of thus far 751 is fully consistent with CABE's recommendations. There are, because the final plan was adopted only some months ago, things are still being developed. The warrant holders are being designated. Respective roles and responsibilities with systems engineering integration are still being worked out. As Susan suggested, the MMT has been useful for lots of reasons, and one of them is, as these roles have developed in the simulations, see what role the ITA plays. As she also noted, they have been active in the SIMS and play a role there in granting of waivers and an operation during flight. So the evidence of ITA's implementation has been found in other places and in the MMT as well. The final note here is that we are expecting that the chief engineer will issue a report on the status of all waivers prior to return to flight. I should note here that the way NASA is implementing this new authority is that all new waivers will have to go through the ITA process. Pre-existing waivers have been reviewed by the program. Many of them have been changed or obviated, and those that remain are analyzed by the program, but ITA also has the ability to look at them, of course, on new waivers and not existing waivers. I should probably pause here, Mr. Chairman, unless you want to wait till the end for questions to see if there are questions on ITA before I go on.
No, I think it's appropriate to get questions at this point.
Dan, when you say the ITA will issue a report on the status of waivers prior to return to flight, I guess that means the flight readiness review.
Right.
And will the report contain a status of all waivers or just the new ones then?
We would hope that it contains a status of all waivers, and I think that it can, because NASA has completed, as I understand it, the review of all existing waivers prior to Columbia. And as we heard just this week, the integrated analysis, the hazards analysis, and other things that can be associated with those waivers has also been reviewed and completed. So it is our hope. It's not, as I said, a condition for closure. It is not a promise, but it's our hope we would see a report on all waivers prior to return to flight. That was easy. The second piece of the CABE recommendation 911 was to have a detailed plan for changes in safety and mission assurance. You'll see here the CABE recommendation. I will note, because we'll talk about it more, it said that the Office of Safety and Mission Assurance should have direct line authority over the entire shuttle program safety organization and should be independently resourced. What CABE was observing was that the program office prior to Columbia was the principal source of funding for safety organizations, and as with other pieces of their recommendations, they were concerned that funding sources dictated limited abilities or limitations to abilities, and also conflicts of interest in assessing safety within the program itself. So they made this recommendation to remove both the authority and the funding from the program, essentially, and have it directly report to NASA headquarters. NASA has chosen to not, in our view, fully comply with the intent of CABE because of those words, direct line authority. NASA's implementation of this has been quite extensive in many ways, as you can see from our reports here and elsewhere. The centers or the funding now comes from NASA headquarters through the chief of SNMA. The head of Safety and Mission Assurance also has much more say about who the center directors are for these activities and other personnel matters. So there's been a lot of authority in some ways and responsibility moved to headquarters. However, the words direct line authority are hard to get around in the CABE recommendation. And NASA has concluded that it is not in quite the right organizational structure for the Safety and Mission Assurance organizations to report directly to headquarters, but rather to report through center directors. So the reporting relationship is not direct. The argument that we find fairly persuasive by NASA has been that center directors need to be involved in the safety operations of their centers. It's not just the program, it's the shuttle program, of course, that they have purview over, and that the center directors need to still be responsible for safety for the parts of the mission and the program that are in their purview. And so the direct line authority has not been part of the new organization on safety, but much of the intent of CABE of making the safety organizations independent of program and giving them more authority have certainly been accomplished. Again, in some of our fact-finding visits to centers themselves, we spent time with folks who were actually out there doing the safety and mission assurance. They felt that their organizations had been reinvigorated, that they were being paid attention to in much greater detail than they had prior to the flight. And so there was certainly a morale change amongst those folks who were actually doing the SMA activities on the ground. So all in all, there's been a substantial change, but we don't believe that what has been done strictly complies with the words of CABE. That is to say, there is not direct line authority. It's through the center directors. With that, I will pause again.
And you know, the interpretation of direct line authority would mean that the center SMMA persons would report directly to headquarters.
Correct.
The intent of making sure that the line of authority was outside the program has been accomplished, and the variation is that the center directors, the SMMA people report to the center director on organizationally.
Correct.
Right. Okay. All right.
And to reiterate that the head of SMMA at headquarters has substantially more authority over those organizations and personnel issues within them than he had before, but the reporting relationship is still through the centers.
I'll ask questions. Any questions before I ask one? Have we had the ability to, review with any CABE members that were part of developing this particular recommendation, whether or not they felt that the way that the agency has implemented change meets what they had hoped to achieve?
I had two conversations I can report on that I didn't put it, I must say, quite as positively as you did. But I asked what they meant by direct line authority. And they said that, as they had with ITA, they thought that there should be a direct report to headquarters. I tried to verify what our interpretation was, as opposed to say, has all that has happened, because this was earlier on in the process and all had not happened. I have not gone back and taken the opportunity to say, this is now the result. Does this meet your intent? But rather early on asked what they meant by direct line authority. So I think the intent of your question, and we have not done any time lately.
But I guess the decision to make it this way came out of the safety office. Is that correct?
Yes.
So they're responsible for the safety. So if anyone knows who should be accountable for it, he's that person or she's that person.
Yeah, there's certainly no...